Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. 50% of Americans think former President Trump's guilty verdict on all 34 counts in his hush money trial was correct. A new ABC News Ipsos poll finds almost as many, 49%, think he should end his 2024 presidential campaign over the result. President Biden proposing a three-phase plan to end the fighting in Gaza. White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby telling ABC's This Week.
This was an Israeli proposal. We have every expectation that if Hamas agrees to the proposal, as was transmitted to them, an Israeli proposal, that Israel would say yes.
But a day after Biden's proposal, Netanyahu's office issuing a statement calling a permanent ceasefire in Gaza a non-starter. Police in Akron are searching for the suspects who opened fire at a street party early this morning, injured at least 25 people and killed a 27-year-old man. If you have a Ticketmaster account, time for a password change after Live Nation confirmed a data breach. This is ABC News. At least one person is dead and more than two dozen others injured after a shooting overnight in Akron, Ohio. According to police, there was a street party happening in the area prior to the shooting. Elizabeth Van Mitri is with ABC TV affiliate WEWS in Cleveland.
During initial investigations, police did find multiple shell casings around. They also did find a gun. No one is in custody at this time. We have a lot more questions than answers, including were there multiple shooters or was it just one shooter? And what led up to all of this morning in Akron?
Atlanta's mayor declaring a state of emergency following massive disruptions to the city caused by multiple water main breaks. But today, the city reports repair crews have made significant progress. ABC's Faith Abube is in Atlanta with more.
Officials were saying that they're waiting for a part to arrive in order to fix one of the main areas. In the meantime, though, they're handing out cases of water and setting up temporary places where people can use the bathroom.
I'm Dave Packer, ABC News.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. I get questions sometimes from folks about whether or not people should buy silver or gold. You know, the actual physical metal itself. Should people buy it, put it in a safe, or bury it in their backyard or something? And I get it. There's something to the allure of a precious metal. You know, gold is tangible. You can hold it in your hands. It's pretty. Gold used to prop up the value of the US dollar. It's been about 50 years since that was the case. But some people feel like buying gold or silver can be a safeguard for their money in uncertain times. Feelings are one thing, and math is something different. And in this case, the math is very clear. A diversified, low-risk portfolio beats a hidey hole full of gold every time. For more insights on how money works, how you can save more and spend less, head on over to workmoney.org. Until next time, this is Carrie Joy saying take good care.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The Bay of Green Bay is nominated to join the 31 habitats of the Natural Estuarine Research Reserve System. Mark Richardson explains the significance.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, called NOAA, has designated the bay on Lake Michigan as the 31st site of habitats along the Great Lakes, coastal states, and territories. Brian Glenazinski, with the Great Lakes Initiative of Ducks Unlimited, says it's a huge win for the region's conservationists.
Some of the things that we gain from the other reserves around the country will not only inform what's happening in Green Bay, but also to tell us what's different about Green Bay and what we need to focus on.
If designated, the proposed site would make Wisconsin one of only three states with multiple reserves, along with California, Florida, and South Carolina. Financial support from the state, the Oneida Nation, and the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin would fund a position on the reserve's staff to ensure that tribal nation perspectives are representative in the site's management and operations.
They continue to provide excellent partnership and the unique perspective that only they can bring to the table.
The proposed reserve is composed of three areas covering almost 38,000 acres of land and water, selected to reflect the unique nature of a large Great Lakes estuary. Lunacinski says the designation is a major accomplishment for the region's conservationists.
That conservation community is pretty special and robust in the area. To have a research reserve like this being placed in an existing conservation community is really just going to take us all to the next level.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have a little fog, then we'll see a mix of clouds and sunshine, southeast to southerly winds, and highs warming to the lower 80s. Chances of showers and storms rolling in for Sunday night. Some of the rain could be locally heavy, lows in the low to mid 60s. It's 75 at our studios.
John Peterson and Gordy Young.
There's an article that's going to come out Monday about John and Gordy on channel3000.com.
And it better be good.
We'll have our review of Doug's review Monday.
The John and Gordy Show, weekday mornings 6 until 8.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, talking all about law and justice, the administration of justice, the delivery of it. Just this past week in a criminal courthouse, a criminal courtroom in Manhattan, talking, yes, about the trial and the conviction by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, finding that indeed the prosecution had met its burden, finding that Donald Trump had engaged in criminal conduct, 34 counts of conviction, felony counts of conviction under New York law. Talking about some of the big takeaways, a couple of more in connection with that. One of them, of course, is this notion that somehow Donald Trump has been mistreated and not treated fairly, as would other defendants in America. In fact, just the opposite is true. Judge Mershon has bent over backwards. Judge Mershon has ensured that this defendant receives all of the protections, procedural, substantive, that would be afforded any defendant in America, in federal court, in state court, in local courts. And this continuing notion articulated by, yes, Donald Trump, and yes, indeed, many others, that somehow this was not the delivery of justice, that somehow this was corrupt, that this was a sham trial, a witch hunt, once again, completely unfounded, completely unsupported by the basic process of this case. Donald Trump afforded every opportunity to cross-examine all the witnesses, afforded the opportunity through his counsel not only to make opening statements, closing arguments, afforded the opportunity, as Judge Mershon indicated, if he chose to do so, to testify on his own behalf. Something that Donald Trump continues to suggest somehow he was prevented from doing, that somehow during the course of the process in this case, things went awry and he was not permitted to present his case, simply untrue. All of that, of course, about the continuing statements, extrajudicial statements being made about what happened here, not only from Donald Trump, but others as well. They are legion and they are all wrong. Especially troubling, again, another big takeaway from what's happening right now are representations, statements made by other people in government about what has happened here and not what's happened here. I'm going to highlight just two of them. One of them is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who, yes, was there during the course of the trial on at least one day with many others, claiming that this trial was a sham, that it was not, in fact, the administration of justice. Indeed, after the return of the verdict, Mike Johnson, third in line for the presidency, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, said this. He said, "I do believe that the Supreme Court," he's talking about the United States Supreme Court, "should step in." He said that Donald Trump was falsely found guilty, inappropriately found guilty, of these criminal charges. He said, this is totally unprecedented and it's dangerous to our system. He went on to say, this is diminishing the American people's faith in our system of justice itself. And to maintain a republic, the speaker went on, you have to have that. People have to believe that justice is fair and that there's equal justice under the law. The justices on the court, I know many of them personally. He's talking about the Supreme Court. I think they're deeply concerned about that, as we all are. And then went on to say, this will be overturned, guys. There's no question about it. It's just going to take some time to do it. Mr. Speaker, no, completely wrong. Completely false in terms of what happened here. Your representations to America and to everyone who would listen in your bully pulpit, which you do have as the speaker, suggesting that the rule of law was not followed here, that the process of judicial proceedings affording the defendant all these rights to be heard, the continuing assumption, the presumption that comes with him until the time of the return of the jury verdict, that he is innocent until proven guilty, all of those things properly done, not at all a sham trial. And indeed, if you are talking to Supreme Court justices right now, Mr. Speaker, about the possibility that one day they may review a final decision by the highest court of New York, that too is improper, not only for you, but also for the Supreme Court justices themselves. All of that by Speaker Johnson in the wake of the return of the verdict, completely inappropriate, irresponsible, reckless, wild, and certainly stirring up exactly the kinds of things that we do not need in this country right now. Offer that Speaker Johnson should be quiet. And while he does not necessarily need to embrace the verdict itself, what he should be saying is, we respect the verdict. And that is indeed what precisely one governor, Larry Hogan, has said, that we respect the verdict, and that's our system. And of course, Larry Hogan, on the receiving end of many, many pieces of criticism and other attacks, alone virtually in the Republican Party for taking that most appropriate view. There's a second one I'll also highlight, also coming from the Congress itself. Susan Collins, senior member of the United States Senate, criticizing the political underpinnings of the lawsuit. Susan Collins going on to say that indeed, the lawsuit, just as Mike Johnson has said, is not to be trusted. The verdict is not to be trusted. Susan Collins, a senator of the United States of America, who has previously condemned Donald Trump for many of his actions, including January 6th, now suggesting to the American public in her bully pulpit that this process was not adequate, that it did not guarantee this defendant all the rights that he was, in fact, guaranteed under New York law and the Constitution, equally irresponsible, reckless, wild, and should be condemned by anyone who is listening to and digesting what Susan Collins has said. I know that Bob has called in from Janesville talking about many of the things being said interpreting this verdict. Bud, that's exactly your comment, your question about this. That is exactly what Americans should be animated about, in addition to the very good things that came out of this legitimate, decent process. The recasting, the recharacterization of this is something other than that by people in positions of responsibility is once again irresponsible, reckless, and should be the subject of condemnation both publicly and privately inside the halls of Congress and by the constituencies who call upon those people to provide leadership. They're doing nothing of the sort right now. Final comment then about all of this. It goes back not only to these issues, these articulated misstatements being made by the Susan Collinses and the Mike Johnsons of the world, but also by Donald Trump himself. And that is that all of this, of course, is human tragedy. We've talked a lot about that in the past, that any time a defendant goes to trial, it is human tragedy. It is necessary. I prosecuted cases for 30 years in the federal courts of the Eastern District of Wisconsin and elsewhere. And although it is absolutely critical, I believe in that process. I believe that there are times when, indeed, a grand jury does need to indict people for their violations of the law, federal law, state law, based upon probable cause findings. The juries do, in fact, need to assess the legitimacy of the evidence presented before them and find those defendants guilty. Why? Because that's a part of our administration of justice that ensures our own safety and security. That's what that's all about. It is a process that necessarily includes defense attorneys who are going to test the legitimacy of those presentations, who are going to suggest to juries, argue to juries appropriately, strenuously, the government has not proven its case, did that for 30 years. That's a part of the process. Nonetheless, I would offer that at this time, in the wake of this catastrophic event, this tragic event involving Donald Trump in American history, there's nothing to celebrate here. This is not a reason for celebration. It is a tragedy for all Americans. It is a tragedy that in the middle of 2024, as we should be focusing upon other issues related to education and commerce and immigration and foreign affairs and all sorts of other things out there, we are instead focusing upon the criminal conduct of a former president and someone who's also running for the presidency right now. It is a tragedy for all Americans that we are doing this. It's a tragedy for those people who are victimized in this trial and in other trials, civil and criminal, by the conduct in which he is engaged. This is a tragedy for everyone involved in this. Nothing to celebrate, recognizing the legitimacy of the result, acknowledging the expertise not only of the prosecution, the critical thinking that came to this result, understanding that all of that is a good codification, an outstanding illustration of how justice should work in America, and embracing that and being pleased, that's the word, pleased about what has happened here because it is an illustration of the rule of law, but also recognizing the tragedy of this prosecution going forward. And yes, I'll also say this out loud. It is a tragedy for Donald Trump and indeed his family as well that this person who is put up in life to have financial success, education success, made these decisions not only here, but plainly in other cases that sent him down a road of criminal conduct, brought his family along with all of this. It is a tragedy for him as well, and that tragedy continues, even as he is sentenced in the middle of July, even as America continues to wrestle with the tragedy of Donald Trump and these other cases also going forward. Conduct in violation of the basic norms, the standards by which we live and work and breathe and get along with each other. That's what all of these cases are about. Criminal prosecution and many types of civil prosecution, tragedies, and that is what we continue to suffer, even though we are pleased and we recognize and we embrace the legitimacy not only of the process that brings him to justice, finally, but also a process that is right and decent based upon what the jury has done, the judge has done, defense counsel has done, prosecution has done, and all of the others who supported this effort. It's like Macbeth. It is like Othello. It's like Richard III. Tragedy in many ways in America. Appreciate, as always, the comments and questions of all of our callers, including those who come in and present us with notes and comments along the way. All of that related to the trial of Donald Trump. Much more of that down the road, obviously, on this broadcast and others, as we continue to analyze and think about what this means, not only with respect to the present campaign for the presidency, but also the future of America, trials, justice, the rule of law, and the delivery of justice going forward. We've talked at great length about the United States Supreme Court. Indeed, Mike Johnson seems to invoke the United States Supreme Court in his recent comments, suggesting that one day they need to get involved and do this as well. I'm going to spend some time in the next segment or so talking more about something the Supreme Court itself did in another area, a First Amendment, Second Amendment case. Talk a little bit more about what you can do if you are concerned about the Supreme Court, not only Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas, but what you can do. A caller last week talked about the efforts and the initiatives that could be taken in reaching out. I'm going to talk more about that in our next segment. And then in our final segments of this broadcast this weekend, we're going to turn and move to the other major events coming up this month, and that is Pride Month in America, as we continue our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
Do you have a loved one in a nursing home? California mega millionaire Eric Hovde has some bad news for you. He doesn't think they have long to live. It's true. In a recent interview, Hovde said, if you're in a nursing home, you only have a 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is at a point to vote. That's shocking. But it gets worse. One of Hovde's companies is named a co-defendant in a wrongful death suit from an incident at a California senior living facility. He even referred to himself as an expert in the nursing home business. Yikes, that doesn't sound like the kind of expert we need. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him that Wisconsin seniors deserve to vote and get the care they deserve. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Incorporated.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. And yes, we're in our second hour of our weekend broadcast, talking principally today, necessarily appropriately, about this major event happening in American history, in American rule of law, that is the conviction of Donald Trump just this past week. Some large takeaways having to do with expertise in prosecution, critical thinking by a jury, the storytelling, this theater, which is not in any way to diminish the significance of that storytelling that results in this finding beyond a reasonable doubt that Donald Trump is guilty of these 34 counts. The inappropriate statements made about what in fact happened in that court, presided over by Juan Merchan, the inaccurate statements, the misleading statements, the politically irresponsible, the governmentally irresponsible and reckless statements made by people, not just Donald Trump, but other people in positions of authority who know better and who nonetheless are providing the American population with reasons to doubt the legitimacy of our processes. All of that a part of our discussion this weekend, and indicating along the way that none of this is a source of celebration. It is indeed tragedy. I mentioned just previously, tragedies like Macbeth and Othello and Richard III, there is something Shakespearean about all of this, a tragedy for America. As always, we appreciate calls and comments. I'm going to take some of those right now before we go on to other subject matter. Let's hear first from Joe. Joe, glad to have you with us this weekend on Amicus.
Yeah, thanks again, Jim. I really appreciate your exhaustive look at this, and it's very helpful. Particularly, I'm calling about the idea of kind of a two-tiered system of justice where, I'm just sort of aghast as I think about it, where the speaker, Mr. Johnson, says, I know many of the people in the Supreme Court personally. Yes. So we're just a phone call away, Don. Don't worry. And then you consider some guy who just got hauled in with a felony charge. Would anybody be calling the Supreme Court to tell them that this guy's coming up and clear the decks so we can make this happen? I cannot believe that Johnson, who is a lawyer, he teaches about the Constitution, and he is the Speaker of the House, could be so derelict in this. It seems like part of a larger plan to me, and the problem I have with it, again, gets to this idea of two-tiered justice. The rich people, just make a phone call and it'll be taken care of. And the same with the idea of prison for Mr. Trump. There's 34 felony convictions, and I don't understand why the idea is that that he wouldn't serve some sort of prison time, that if he gets away with just simply paying a fine, this rich guy just has to pay a fine, you're yet again in the territory of you can mouth off to the judge. There's no safety for these jurors. They've been apparently told that people are wanting to go after them after the outcome of this trial. They aren't safe. How does he get to that system where it's two-tiered justice, Jim? That's what I see as two-tiered justice. I'd appreciate your thoughts on that.
Joe, thank you, as always, for that insightful comment. And indeed, there's a reason to be concerned about two-tiered justice. When you've got the Speaker of the House of Representatives inserting himself in this judicial process, which, as I've indicated, full of integrity and decency and propriety along the way, suggesting not only that it is suspect and that it is corrupt, but then indicating, Joe, as you've repeated as well, that I'm just going to pick up the phone. And I have, in fact, spoken to Supreme Court justices. Don't worry, this will be taken care of. They're very concerned about this as well. Wildly, wildly inappropriate. And again, one of the things I'm going to be doing in just a few moments or so is once again advocating that we reach out to these people and tell them individually, as citizens of America, the speaker is the speaker for all of us, that he shouldn't be doing this. Susan Collins is a United States senator. Donald Trump may be the next president of the United States of America. All these comments suggesting that the rule of law is not existent in America, or at least it's not existent for him, when in fact just the opposite is true. And the two-tiered system that you're suggesting, which again is that Donald Trump maybe, presumably has the financial resources to hire lawyers and defend himself, an awful lot of people out there, Joe, as you've just indicated, do not have those accesses to the Susan Collinses and the Mike Johnsons. And the Supreme Court of the United States of America, two-tiered justice indeed, if indeed we are to believe these people on Capitol Hill. Secondarily, I agree entirely that when we talk about deterrence, there's that word once again, deterrence not only specific as to Donald Trump, but also generally to people who might engage in similar kinds of things. And yes, there are quite literally hundreds of these kinds of prosecutions all the time, not just in New York, but in states around the nation. Don't do this. Why? Because you will suffer the same kind of thing that Donald Trump suffered as a result of his criminal conduct. All of that has got to animate the judge's sentence here. And although, again, the statistics indicate that people who suffer these first kinds of criminal convictions do not traditionally suffer any kind of incarcerative sentence, here's a situation where Juan Merchan, based upon recommendations and the lack of remorse by this defendant, statements made by this defendant suggesting the process is a sham, he may in fact do it. And my own view is just like yours, Joe, that there should be some period, however limited, of Donald Trump in an incarcerative detention type setting to send the message not only to him to knock it off, to deter him from doing this, but also to do others the same sort of messaging. Very important comments to make and to articulate. Appreciate as well a call in from Dick this weekend. Dick, appreciate your calling in from Madison.
Yeah, I could not agree with Joe more. I mean, she hit it out of the park with everything she said. I'm seeing something else, James, too, with the way the Senate and the House representatives on the, you know, Republican side have handled this. And it's this. This was their last opportunity to do the right thing. And the things that they're saying and that they're doing, the only way they have a future in politics is if Trump were to win. Because if he loses, this party, in my mind, is just shot. It's going to have to start over in some other form, way, shape, or form, because it can't continue on the course it's on. They think that one man is above the law, and they think that they can, you know, move this to the Supreme Court they've stacked. And I don't believe any of it. And we've got to go out and just crush this at the polls, because this party needs to examine itself.
And Dick, appropriate comments all across the board once again. You know, as you indicated, this notion that we've got these people out there who are describing this appropriate event in a way that gives people reason to doubt the seriousness of government here generally and the problems that are existing when, in fact, they're not. I agree entirely when it comes to the kinds of things that America should be responding to. We should be outraged by those kinds of messages. Again, what you do is, by Governor Hogan, you can say that you may, in fact, disagree if you've analyzed the facts yourself. You may disagree with the verdict, but you respect the process and you respect the fact that 12 people in that trial courtroom witnessing what the witnesses were testifying to, looked at the documents, you respect that process enough to say, I embrace the verdict, I respect it. I also embrace the sentencing prospect. I embrace the appellate prospects here, all those kinds of things, but I don't indicate that very process upon which our nation's been built for more than 240 years is suspect and should no longer be trusted. That's the great danger. And that is, Dick, as you said, just in the middle of this campaign. That's why we can't tolerate this kind of thing and need to respond emphatically. We have talked at great length about the Supreme Court and the kinds of things that the Supreme Court is wrestling with these days. One of the things that we've talked about in the past is the possibility of writing to the Supreme Court and telling them how we feel about some of the ethics issues along the way. Last week, a caller said, what is that address, Jim? And I've got it for you now. If you are interested in writing to Chief Justice John Roberts, or any of the associate justices, including but not limited to Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas and all the others, here's the address. It's 1 First Street, Northeast, Washington, D.C., 20543. When we come back, more Rule of Law on this Amicus weekend.
Lake Air, 1260 AM, WLAK.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. 50% of Americans think former President Trump's guilty verdict on all 34 counts in his hush money trial was correct. A new ABC News Ipsos poll finds almost as many, 49%, think he should end his 2024 presidential campaign over the result. President Biden proposing a three-phase plan to end the fighting in Gaza. White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby telling ABC's This Week.
This was an Israeli proposal. We have every expectation that if Hamas agrees to the proposal, as was transmitted to them, an Israeli proposal, that Israel would say yes.
But a day after Biden's proposal, Netanyahu's office issuing a statement calling a permanent ceasefire in Gaza a non-starter. Police in Akron are searching for the suspects who opened fire at a street party early this morning, injured at least 25 people and killed a 27-year-old man. If you have a Ticketmaster account, time for a password change after Live Nation confirmed a data breach. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
A Brewers win in extra innings. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers and the White Sox battled to a 3-3 tie, sending it into extra innings. Bottom of the 10th, Willie Adames at the plate. Brian Anderson with the call on Bally Sports Wisconsin.
Ground ball. It's gloved. It's off the ground. Contreras will stroll in. And the ball game is over. The Brewers win. It is Adames who delivers in the clutch again. And the Brewers win 4-3 in 10 innings.
So the White Sox have now lost 10 in a row. Brewers starter, though, Robert Gasser, struggled despite the victory.
You know, Gasser didn't have his best stuff for sure. He just didn't, there's no finish on anything. He didn't look super sharp. No swing and miss. When that many barrels, I started thinking they had a tip. Lefty sweeper, left on left sweeper.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have a little fog, then we'll see a mix of clouds and sunshine, southeast to southerly winds, and highs warming to the lower 80s. Chances of showers and storms rolling in for Sunday night. Some of the rain could be locally heavy, lows in the low to mid 60s. Right now it's 76.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matt and Air on Air with Jane Matt and Air. Weekdays 10 till noon on Lake Air 107.5 FM and 1260 AM WLAK and on the Civic Media app.
My friends swim no matter the season, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. Now, thanks to Skyrizi and clear skin, count me in. With Skyrizi, Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150-milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. 3 out of 4 people achieve 90% clear skin at 4 months.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Ask your doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. And visit SkyRizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones in your area. Check 511WI.gov or download the free 511 app to see current road work, closures, detours, and camera views on your route. Wherever your travels take you, know before you go with 511WI.gov. That's 511WI.gov. And remember, know before you go. Always park the phone while driving. Sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Crude and Dom.
Tune in to the next Devil's Advocates radio show. We'll tell you whether or not Trump is fleeing prosecution to a extraditionalist country. Tune in Monday.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel. This is the second hour of our weekend broadcast, focusing, as always, on the rule of law, on the delivery of justice, and the operations of government in our nation and beyond. A part of that, of course, focusing, as always, upon the courts. And in our remaining time this weekend, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Supreme Court. Then I'm going to talk about a federal district court decision some 10 years ago that changed the way in which we think about human beings in America and in our state of Wisconsin. Have some special guests. We're going to be calling in and talking with us about that major event. Just this past week, the Supreme Court, again, in the midst of its time period, when it begins to issue some of these major decisions, issued a major case, a major opinion in a case called NRA versus Vulo. Supreme Court sided with the National Rifle Association on Thursday, finding that the group could in fact litigate a First Amendment claim against a New York State official who had encouraged companies to stop doing business with it after that remarkable, horrific, terrible 2018 shooting in Parkland, Florida. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, writing for a unanimous court, 9-0 here, found that the NRA had, in fact, claimed a plausible cause of action, plausibly claimed a violation of the First Amendment, not finding it, but arguing and maintaining, stating that indeed the NRA does have a claim that it can litigate on the lower courts, and reversing an appeals court and sending the case back for those further proceedings. Although a government official, she said, is allowed to share her views freely and criticize particular beliefs, the Supreme Court, Justice Sonia Sotomayor again writing, that official may not use the power of the state to punish or suppress disfavored expression. This case, of course, one of two major cases this term, which we've talked about, in which the justices are wrestling with when government advocacy by various entities crosses a constitutional line into coercion. The other case is also out there, is involving Murthy versus Missouri. It also has to do with whether or not the Biden administration efforts to stop the disinformation placement upon platforms, social media platforms, is appropriate. Likely a completely different result in that case, the Supreme Court in Murthy, indicating that probably will support that advocacy, but not when it's coercive. Not when it is attempting to do something that expresses power against an agency, in this case, the NRA. NRA versus Vulo, a major case, a unanimous decision just this past week coming out of the United States Supreme Court. Other major rule of law snapshots, things, as we know, are going on right now in our world. We know recently coming out of South Africa that the voting there has basically determined that the African National Congress, which has been the party in power, the parliamentary authority for about 30 years, ever since apartheid was brought down there, has lost its majority for the first time in 30 years. Lots to look at there, receiving just about over 40% in the election, well short of the majority it needed, and that's held to continue to operate there as the leading governmental power, has to put together a coalition government. Fascinating issues there with respect to the rule of law and justice as well. And we also know that to the immediate south in the nation of Mexico, tomorrow, the voters there in the country of Mexico are going to the polls to elect their next president. Almost certainly, they're going to elect a woman named Claudia Sheinbaum. She's a PhD. She's got a shared Nobel Peace Prize. The first woman elected to lead Mexico City, her nation's capital, one of the largest cities in the Western Hemisphere, almost certainly going to be elected on Sunday, that is this weekend, as the president of Mexico, beating America to the time when a woman can and should be serving in these important positions. Not without its controversy, there are lots of things that she is going to be taking on, including the fact that during the course of this election, literally about 36, almost 40 people have been killed in various positions seeking office in Mexico during this very term. A lot of violence there as well, with which he's also going to have to contest that election this weekend in Mexico, again, as a part of our rule of law snapshots. We are anticipating not only this month, but throughout the year, of course, a further focus on this broadcast and others focusing upon human rights and civil rights. This is Pride Month in America, that time when we specifically acknowledge the privacy rights, same-sex marriage, relationships that are important across the board. And indeed, today on this broadcast and coming up this week, this weekend in particular, at Pride Fest in Milwaukee, a special celebration of the 10-year anniversary of a major decision coming out of a federal district court and affirmed by an appellate court here in the Seventh Circuit, a case called Wolf versus Walker, a federal lawsuit filed in February of 2014, decided in June of 2014, 10 years ago, and challenging at that time Wisconsin's refusal to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples, refusal to recognize same-sex marriages established in other jurisdictions, and some related statutes. In June of 2014, Judge Barbara Crabb, who is in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Wisconsin, ruled for the plaintiffs. And in the in that particular ruling, she said in particular that this kind of discrimination, sexual orientation discrimination, is subjected to heightened scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause, under long-established rules and regulations, and found that, indeed, that the state's same-sex marriage ban must be substantially related to an important government objective to survive. It does not survive. And in this case, Judge Barbara Crabb finding and affirming the right of same-sex couples to marry in the state of Wisconsin. This happening also, of course, while the federal Supreme Court wrestling with cases like Windsor and Obergefell, that, of course, in other times right around the same period, the federal court ultimately likewise affirming the same thing under our Constitution. Wisconsin, again, based upon this federal case affirming the right of same-sex couples to marry in the state. We celebrate and we recognize this week, this month, as always, the 10-year anniversary of that major decision, and we are delighted. We are honored today and this weekend on our broadcast to have some of the plaintiffs in that case from 10 years ago. I'm going to talk with them in the remaining time that we have here on our broadcast. I'm going to begin with two of the plaintiffs, and their names are Pam Kleiss and Salud Garcia of Madison. Pam and Salud, we're delighted to have you with us today. Welcome to Amicus, a Law Review.
Thank you so much for having us. This is Salud.
Yep, and hello, this is Pam.
Salud and Pam, again, delighted to have you with us. I've done a very much abbreviated version of the litigation in which you were involved long before 10 years ago, but certainly much in your mind, in our mind again, as we acknowledge and celebrate the 10-year anniversary of what you and others as plaintiffs accomplished by advocating on behalf of civil rights here in the state of Wisconsin, I'd argue throughout the country, leading to the federal acknowledgement also of same-sex rights. Let me begin by asking the two of you, what animated you at the time? Can you go back 10 years ago and tell us what prompted you to join this lawsuit and say, yes, we want to be heard. We want to affirm this basic human right. What prompted you to make that major decision that had to be the subject of an awful lot of deliberation before you made it?
Well, first of all, neither Pam or I can really tolerate bullies. So that was part of it. go ahead.
I think the major thing is the things that face all families in Wisconsin and America, which is being able to get health insurance, being able to take care of our children, which in this case we have one child who at that time was, 12.
Mm-hmm.
And had some special needs that needed medical care. And I think the other part of it, too, was just that grounding and knowing that we could take care of our family.
Yes.
As we move through all of the things that happen with job changes, with health changes, with, you know, just maintaining our economic security.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Pam said, all through the trial and everything, there are a lot of rights that are tied to marriage. And so it was it continues to be a big deal when people can't access those rights because of discriminatory language and discriminatory laws.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we talk generally about privacy rights, but that is a very broad umbrella, right? That's the point that you're making, that, right. Yes, it is about same-sex relationships and the legitimacy of all those personal interactions. Also, the practical implications you just talked about, again, health insurance, your family, it's broader than just this, right? And I suspect that too animated your interest in being a part of this. It's beyond just this issue. As important as this is, it has implications well beyond the specifics of this lawsuit.
Right. I mean, the eight couples, you know, there was so many different examples of when discriminatory laws or even discriminatory practices just really impacted our families in painful, negative ways.
Yeah, we had couples that were older couples who were facing, you know, later in life challenges of healthcare and being able to be present with their loved one through a healthcare crisis. There mm-hmm. were younger couples who were getting married and had been married in another state. And then when finding a wonderful job opportunity in Wisconsin, found that they couldn't have the same rights and abilities to care for each other once they moved to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, we moved to Wisconsin from Seattle, where we had a recognized domestic partnership mm-hmm. and where our child was born, and we were able to adopt our child legally. In
what she means is I was able to adopt
yes right
I became a legal parent, right, not just, mm-hmm. you know, a hanger on,
right, and through that adoption we realized that was the sole legal document that tied the three of us together,
right.
And we kept that document, especially it wasn't laminated or anything mm-hmm. like that, but we thought as we travel, like on vacation or something, this is the one document that shows that Salud had a right to our child's healthcare decision making, for example, or anything like that. So as we faced new jobs in Wisconsin, as we realized that Salud's employer would not budge on giving me health insurance,
mm-hmm.
Despite having other team members, their spouses and people that were at home caring for their children were able to extend that privilege to their spouses. So it just became more and more frustrating
mm-hmm.
To have to make do and figure out different ways to do things when for all extended purposes, we were a family living in a domestic relationship that is honored in this country in many, many ways. We didn't want it. We didn't want this have to be an employer dependent,
right.
Right. Or state dependent, or you know, we had to extend to other people's consciousness to try and get these rights.
Right.
They should be and would mm-hmm. be embedded.
Right.
Absolutely. So you know, as I listen to you talk, I'm also inspired, as I suspect all of our listeners are as well, by the gravity of your decision not only to become involved in this lawsuit. There had to be things, we talk a lot on this broadcast about the processes of trials and the processes of mm-hmm. courts and depositions, which I know you were subject to, and the tussle. And this is no easy thing. I wonder if you could chat with us a little bit about the challenges that you undertook in addressing the issues that you're just describing and how you overcame those both personally, individually, as a family, even emotionally. What did that look like, the struggle itself? Can you comment about that a bit?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question, but let's start from the very beginning with our child's birth. Our child was born very early, and Pam had to be in the hospital on bed rest for a week prior to that. And in Seattle is a pretty liberal city. And so at first everything, you know, it looked like the hospital was going to be good to us and treat us like a family. And on the day of Jesse's birth, which was completely unexpected, I was supposed to get a little bracelet that said I was Jesse's parent. And what happened was that the nurse who was supposed to do that, or the assistant or whatever, wouldn't give it to me because I wasn't a family member. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Pam is bleeding, and so they're not able to stop bleeding, so they have to take her into an operating room.
And Pam, I'm gonna interrupt you right now just because I need to do a little bit of a break here. I want mm-hmm. you to stay on the line.
You're listening to Lake Air WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast format? Search no more. Find it now on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio. Your news just for the Amory area. I'm James Kelly with WLAK News.
Max Inc. Radio.
His voice is a dream. Coming up, Eau Claire musician Brian Bethke joins us live for an in-studio concert. I'm Terry Barr. Join me, Rucker, and Jimmy Kay.
Weekend evenings, 6 until midnight, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
Melissa was my neighbor in L.A. Her husband Jim would break open these $100 bottles of wine they just have sitting around.
A friend of mine and I went to his friend's house. Her dad put like a $500 bottle of scotch down on the table and was like, hey, I got this for you guys. Like, go ahead. We're 18. We can't appreciate this. I've never had an alcoholic beverage in my life until my 21st birthday.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, Aloraview. My name, Jim Santel, talking right now with Salud Garcia and Pam Kleiss of Madison, talking about the things that prompted them to file and engage in this lawsuit. It resulted in the recognition by a federal court here in Wisconsin, same-sex marriage in Wisconsin. And right before we broke necessarily, Pam and Salud, you were talking about the specific medical situation with Jesse's birth that prompted all of this. Go ahead and give us more of that story.
Okay. So in that instant, I could have lost everything because we were not married. If Pam had died, I'm sure her parents would have taken Jesse and never let me see him again. And I would have been totally bereft. So fortunately that didn't happen. One of my brother-in-laws was able to talk the staff into letting me have the bracelet. Then when we came to Wisconsin, I worked for an organization for 10 years. And in that 10 years, they never extended domestic partner benefits, even though other places in Wisconsin did. So for 10 years, when Pam was at home caring for our child, because our child had special needs, we couldn't put Jesse in a regular preschool. We didn't feel comfortable with that. She had little to no health care, even though I had peers at my organization who, same situation, spouse at home taking care of the kids, they had health insurance, they had all the other benefits of marriage. It really made me so angry. And I was telling a friend of mine who works for the ACLU when the lawsuit first started about our experience and how angry I was. And I was, you know, when the marriage amendment first went through the legislature, I cried. I couldn't believe that this was happening. It was so blatantly discriminatory, especially when the gay and lesbian community wasn't pushing for marriage in Wisconsin. It was just like typical bullying. And we were so furious. And when the ACLU reached out and asked if we'd be plaintiffs, both of us were kind of in tentative. Pam had just started a job, and I was in between jobs. And, you know, there was some possibility that maybe people would then know our names and there'd be backlash and maybe I wouldn't be able to find a job and Pam would lose her job. But we still said, no, this is wrong.
And we wanted to pursue this, right?
Right.
And,
yeah. right? And
And Pam and Salute, we are going to be talking more about this at Pride Fest in Milwaukee this coming Friday afternoon and evening, a special program not only celebrating what you have done, but also the other plaintiffs. I'm proud to say I'm a part of that presentation along with Larry Dupuy, who is one of your lawyers at the time. We're going to be talking about all of this, right? And I want to thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk to Virginia next in our remaining moments here, so I'm going to complete our conversation. More of that. We're going to bring Virginia in, who's also one of your plaintiffs, Virginia Wolf. But Pam and Salud, thank you so much for being with me. Virginia, thank you for waiting. We're talking, obviously, about your advocacy and appreciate your being on the line, telling us all about what motivated you to be a part of this plaintiff class 10 years ago and even more than that, that brought about this significant result for same-sex marriage and civil rights generally in Wisconsin. Talk with me about what motivated you to become involved in all of this.
Well, I think originally the worst thing that happened to us was that I was in the emergency room and the nurse wouldn't let Carol be with me. And I was thinking that I was having a heart attack. And finally, I just started screaming and throwing a fit. Then the nurse got frightened. And so she finally did allow Carol into the emergency room.
And that's Carol Schumacher, your partner, right? Carol Schumacher, right?
Carol Schumacher,
also a plaintiff in this case, right? Go ahead. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And after that, we did all sorts of things. We got wills. We got power of attorney for health care, power of attorney for finances. And, you know, we thought we were protected. But then I almost drowned. Carol saved me. But, you know, she wasn't a relative. So the question of whether or not she could get in the ambulance with me and go to the hospital, had she not known one of the EMTs, we wouldn't have succeeded in having her be with me. So
stunning,
I mean,
shocking.
We had experiences like this over and over again. I mean, Carol couldn't get my Social Security. I mean, we're both retired. We're both older. And she couldn't get my Social Security as a wife normally could, you know, when she turned, before she turned 65. And I mean, we started, we were in the domestic partnerships suit. We went in 2004 and asked for a marriage license from the county. So we've been doing this kind of stuff for a long time for pretty obvious reasons. And of course, we're particularly fearful because now we're in the last stages of life, and what if something happens to us? And, you know, who can, you know, this is all in our thought as we were.
Basic human rights, basic concerns of every living human being, right? Right.
Yeah. I want to tell you, Jim, there's 200 rights and protections in Wisconsin. There's over 1,100 federal rights that we didn't have until we got married. So that's a lot of rights.
That is. And I assume that you're going to be joining. Perhaps Carol's going to join, but also Salud, Pam, others at Pride Fest this coming weekend, Friday in particular, this wonderful event. I assume you'll be able to tell your stories more and even animate us more to be concerned not only about the future, but also where we are right now, right? And being a part of that initiative too.
The present has really been such a relief for us because now, you know, we have all of those benefits and so forth. But I am really worried about the future. I mean, with Clarence Thomas's statement about revisiting same-sex
and Dobbs
marriage,
revisiting privacy rights, right? Exactly. Same-sex marriage, contraception,
Or Tennessee saying that you can discriminate on the grounds of religion. You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on right now that's really scary.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
And Pam.
But also, I want to say this too. We're gonna celebrate.
Yes,
same-sex marriages too. We're gonna have a renewal of vows.
Yes, renewal of vows on the campus there at Pride Fest at 7 o'clock on Friday, June 7th. You, Virginia, Carol's going to be there. Salud, Pam, and all the other plaintiffs also going to be there to celebrate and renew vows. I'm also very pleased that you've invited me and Larry to talk about the present and the future of not only privacy rights, but same-sex rights. What a wonderful time to be thoughtful about where we are and where we need to be in the future as well. And appreciate so much your being a part of this. Looking forward to being with you, Virginia, being with Carol, Salud, Pam, and all of your co-plaintiffs at this time of historical recognition and also a commission for the future. Thank you so much, Virginia, being with me. I'm looking forward to seeing you.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
Maggie Dawn.
Next up, we kick off Biden's top 100. The week's theme is the economy, and we'll be specifically talking about the billionaires tax. Why don't we tax billionaires more?
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4. It's time for Civic Media's Scotty Summer Text to Win contest right here on this local Civic Media radio station. We're hooking you up with Wisconsin Dells prize packs, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, plus the chance to win a summer getaway to Door County, Lake Geneva, or a lake house vacation. Download the free Civic Media app in the Google Play or App Store and get ready to text in for your first chance to win in this statewide contest starting Monday, June 3rd at 7 a.m. It's Civic Media's Scotty Summer. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.